get started. So glad you're here. Let me just say this. I love you. Let's get started. We got a lot of material to cover. And I do want to say that really this is part one of the two-part series. Tomorrow we'll cover should a Christian or should Christians support Israel. And I really believe before we answer that question, we need to have some history with regard to all of that. So let's get started with talking about what we mean as we think about ancient and modern. Let's define some of our terms. Well, when we talk about Israel and should a Christian support Israel, what do we mean? Number one, we could be talking about religious Israel. And with regard to religious Israel, there is biblical Israel, which of course we are most familiar with, our biblical Judaism. And then there is Talmudic or rabbinic Judaism that really became more and more popular after the destruction of the temple in AD 70. It sort of took the place then of the destruction of the temple, and also with the Talmud being utilized as the main source, you know, beyond just the Bible itself. So we've got that. And then among those various, are there various sectarian groups, in rabbinic Judaism, the ultra-Orthodox, or the Haredim, the Orthodox, the conservative movement and the reform movement. This is how I typically like to sort of classify them. Sometimes you'll see it more classified like this with liberal Judaism, conservative Judaism, and Orthodox Judaism. But again, very different from what we know to be biblical Judaism, but yet it plays an important role in this entire discussion. And then under all of that, you can see the various divisions and differences. We might think of them as sort of denominations within, quote, the world of Christianity, okay? So that's what we mean, number one, is that it could be religious Israel, but also we need to recognize and understand, all right, come on, there we go, that we could be talking about political Israel. And that's really more or less where we're gonna end up today and tomorrow, talking about political Israel. And by that I mean that it's a governmental entity whose citizens and lawmakers represent a wide variety of races, religious views, and ethnic groups. So when someone asks you, do you support Israel, you need to find out what they mean by that. What are we talking about? Is it political Israel or is it religious Israel? Of course, in many instances, they're greatly intertwined, but as you're going to see here, today in Israel, there are several races making up its citizenship. Religiously, there are Muslims of various extremes. There are Christians, in a broad sense, of course, of that term, of various denominations. And there are Jews of various sectarian branches that we've just talked about. Notice this now. 72% of Israeli citizens today are of Jewish. They would claim that they are of Jewish heritage. Nearly one half are either atheists or would identify themselves as secular. Now that sort of boggles the mind a little bit, doesn't it, to think about Israel when we think about that country. And then 21% are Arab, 5% other, which would include a whole number of other groups like Orthodox and the Catholics, Armenians and so forth, all right? Now, sometimes people are surprised to see this. See, now notice, 21% Arab of a citizenship, they have citizenship in the nation of Israel. And it's nothing to drive through Israel, the state of Israel today, and see communities of Arabic Muslim people, some of which are on the Knesset. They have a political party as a part of the governmental governing agency of Israel. So that is, to me, an extremely important thing to get around. We're talking about, by and large, a cosmopolitan nation made up of a lot of differing religious groups, ideologies, and people who are Arabic Muslims who are citizens of the state of Israel. Okay, they have the right to vote. They have many rights and privileges. I wish I had time to tell you some stories about that. All right, well, knowing where Israel is extremely important. And as an introduction, by way of the Fertile Crescent, we're familiar with, I'm sure, the area of the Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers, and that it will, by some geographers, come on down here to the Nile River. But notice that we're talking about a very small country wedged in around Arabic nations. Very small. Look at the, you know, the scale there compared to the United States. Okay? So again, that's an important thing that we'll, I think, factor in just a moment. Now, when we think about just how small it is, represented today in this little area here, you can see part of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip that has obviously been in the news. That territory belonging to Israel, except for the southern part, about right here and up there, is 1/4 the size of the state of Alabama. Biblical extent of the land described is often from Dan to Beersheba, which is about 150 miles as the crow flies, and then 30 to 55 miles wide. So think about that. If you were living somewhere in a world that is pretty much in opposition to you, and you've got a small sliver of land, do you think that in some ways you might be on the defensive? Do you think there might be some skirmishes, some problems? Absolutely. That's part of the history of both modern and ancient Israel. Now, when we think about biblical times as well as today, I want you to think about this quote from James Monson from his book, Regions on the Run, publication by Biblical Backgrounds Incorporated. He says that security and peace are not characteristics of the land of the Bible. The north was under the shadow of imperial invasion and highways. In the west were common military objectives. Marauders from the south and east posed a threat to settled populations and to the commerce. And when empires retreated, local nations fought bitterly in order to control the land's highways. And so periods of peace and security were few, short, and far between. I believe that's an important part of our understanding to appreciate what the people of God faced as they lived in this small country where God brought them to. Now, we know that the promised land that God promised them, that they had available to them, was much larger than that. They never really realized the full extent of God's blessings that he wanted to pour upon them. Sort of sounds familiar to all of us, doesn't it? We don't always do that because we don't have enough faith sometimes. We don't trust. We don't obey as we should. And that was the issue with Israel. But they are wedged in here on a highway, as it were, of trade. Now, what do we call it? We'll come back to that in just a moment, by the way. But what do we call this? Because that's another important, this land. That's another important part of this whole discussion as we as Christians are interacting with the world and talking about political issues and understanding what's happening in the world. We want to be careful about the language that we use and the terms that we use. Well, we know biblically that the Bible describes this land as the land of Canaan. Canaan was a descendant of Ham. And so as they dwelt pretty much more to the northern area, the descendants of Shem that become the Semitic people, kind of a little bit more further south. But the Bible also calls this the land of Israel, a land promised to Abraham and his descendants. So Abraham begot Isaac, Isaac begot Jacob, and his name was changed to Israel. And so his family, we know, came to settle in this land that had been promised to Abraham. And those 12 tribes then settled in this area that, of course, is under dispute today. So we're talking about a period going back to 1400 BC now, roughly, when this land, the Bible in one instance called it a holy land. And by that, it means that it was a land consecrated or sanctified or set apart, really, for God's people. Not holy in the sense that if you touched it, that somehow you might receive some sort of, you know, spiritual encouragement or, you know, transformation in some way. I don't refer to it today as the Holy Land. Some people do, and I don't, you know, have a big quarrel about that. I just typically refer to them as the Bible lands, and I know some people will be offended at that. But nevertheless, there is one time which the Bible refers to this area as a holy land. Now, this is a very important part of our discussion right here, because nowhere in the Old Testament does the Bible call this land that we're talking about Palestine. And yet in most of our maps that we will study and perhaps photographs that you've seen from time to time labeling these you know, these areas that we're so familiar with in the Bible, it might refer to them as the land of Palestine. And they'll say, see, the Bible calls them that. And that's not true. The word Philistia, when used in these instances, was referring to an area just kind of on the southwestern border, the coastal area where the Philistines were located, the dreaded enemy of the Israelite for many years during Old Testament history. So where did the word Palestine come from? It wasn't until around 63 BC when the Romans, Pompey, conquered that territory, east of the Mediterranean, this area here, that it eventually became a Roman province. Remember how Rome was so unique in how it structured its empire to effectively control it and create trade and commerce and so forth. So they separated it into a provincial system, and they eventually would make this territory, first given to an Idumean king, Antipater, and then later on Herod, who, after his family couldn't really control it, then finally Judea became the governing area for Rome and this province that they now are going to call Palestine. So the Romans were really the first one to call it that. Now, why did they do that? I think there was a reason. They wanted to insult the Jews by drawing upon a name that they knew came from their history that was, degrading to them, okay? So, that's an important word. So, when we refer to Palestine, again, it's very charged, because what do we mean by that? Were these people living there today, are they Palestinian people? Were they there during the time that the Romans created this place? And I would argue that they were not, okay? All right, so geographically, what about this land? And then we'll get into a sort of history of this entire land. But what are some names associated with this land? Well, I'll put them all up here one time for the sake of time. Sometimes we refer to it as the Near East. We talk about Middle Eastern conflict or Middle Eastern politics. What are we talking about? Well, if you know your European history, and when Constantine moved the capital from Rome over here to Istanbul, and even actually before that with Diocletian, who created the Tetrarchy and divided his empire into four, east and west, and then two lesser divisions, it began to create a sort of cultural shift, economic shift to the east and to the west. That then historically, a number of things began to develop in the east because of the Orthodox Church here, and then the Roman Latin Church to the west. And so from basically here, that direction, we tend to think of east. So the world is divided into east and west, politically, theologically, and so forth in many ways, although it's never quite that easy, but and quite that nice. But nevertheless, when we talk about the Middle East and the Near East, this is the Near East, this area here, this is the Middle East, and then the Far East, of course, would be places like India, okay? So Middle Eastern politics has to do with these Arabic countries that are there today, the Arabian Peninsula, the Mesopotamia, and then this area here, also referred to as the Levant, is the area that we are interested in as far as its dispute. And as we think about why that term really became popular, it was an old mariner's term, term of geography, but politically it became important because, see, it's not charged with any particular position. It's not the land of Israel. It's not, it's not Palestine. It's the Levant. And so the Levant then is a term that was used in a number of different languages to refer to as mariners came this direction. They could see the sun rising over here. So this was the land where the sun would rise off in the east. So that's where that particular term came from. I think that maybe for today, and to just sort of cool the discussion just a bit, is to say, let's talk about this as a land between, a land between. And part of the reason I want us to see it in this way is to understand not only the history of ancient Israel, the things that they faced, but also what's going on over there today. Quite literally, this is a land bridge, because this small parcel of land here is bordered on the east by the Arabian Desert, on the west by the Mediterranean Sea, And then the major empires and power players of history. In Egypt, down here to the south, and then countries like Assyria, Babylon, the Medo-Persian Empire, coming from the Mesopotamia area. Well, as these empires would rise and fall, and they would expand, think about what they need. They want access to trade. They want access to the trade routes. They sometimes want maybe the agricultural produce that might be garnered from a particular area. Not so much Israel, although it was there, but they saw this more as a highway. All right, it's a trade route. We want to control the big interstate highway because the Egyptians are going to come up here. They want trade that's coming across out of the Persian Gulf up to Mesopotamia over to the west. The Assyrians and the Babylonians, they want to come down here and have a presence here as well for the trade that might be coming up from the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aqaba and then on up into Israel in that direction as well. So this is a land between, but it's also a crossroads. Now, think about that theologically as far as the Old Testament is concerned. God put his people here. This is the next slide, but I'm going to talk about it here. He put them here because he said, I'm giving you a good land, a land flowing with milk and honey. It's a land agriculturally with opportunity. But you're going to have to trust me. You're a small country wedged between dominant world empires, right? And Deuteronomy 7 says, don't form coalitions with the neighboring nations to protect yourself. We see that happening even today. Ukraine, understandably. They're a smaller country maybe in terms of its power and might compared to Russia or other places in the world. And so they immediately began to seek alliances with neighboring nations to say, come help us against the Russians. All right? The Israelites were tempted to do very much the same thing. We've got to form a coalition to protect ourselves from the Assyrians, the Babylonians. So Isaiah speaks of this, for example, in Isaiah 40 and other places. Don't go down to Egypt to help or for help. Don't trust in chariots, right? Trust in God. You lean upon me. I will protect you. And that's, again, a very, very important geographical consideration that we need to take to the text when we're thinking about how God protected his people. But I also want to say, in terms of modern history, for the nation of Israel as a state that exists here today, that one of the issues had to do with the Straits of Tehran right here, and the Egyptians cutting off the Israelites, or the people of Israel, the nation of Israel now, modern history, of being able to take their ships up into here to have access then to bring them to their country from this part of the world, right? Well, they do have a harbor here at Caesarea, or north of Caesarea, Haifa, and then Ashdod down here to the south. But this is another important part of trade that comes from that part of the world. So if the Egyptians cut this off, well, that's cutting off a huge part of our lifeline. It creates a lot of controversy, see? So geographically, we need to try to understand what's happening in the world, both biblical times and modern times, to see what maybe is creating some of the conflict, okay? So God put them here, and he said, I want you to trust me. This is a highway that people are going to be using, and so as you do that, don't form coalitions, Deuteronomy 7. But also agriculturally, we don't have time to talk about this, but this is a transitional zone. It's a semi-arid climate, where the north is wet, where the south is drier. So they're right on this transition zone where you may or may not get rain. God says, I'll send you the early rain and the latter rain, Deuteronomy chapter 11, if you'll not worship idols. And of course, they were tempted and did at times worship Baal, particularly the northern tribes. The storm god, the one that brought the rain. So you see the compromise. You see they're hedging their bets, saying, okay, we see you, Yahweh, as the true God, but maybe we should worship Baal as well. Okay? All right, so don't form coalitions. All right, now, with that in mind, geographically, kind of thinking about ancient and modern, let's talk a little bit about the history then of the land between that encompasses so many things, like the modern state of Israel, like biblical Israel that we think of. And I've got a timeline that I sent over to Cody, and I think he was going to try to upload that. I believe that's possible to get that. So you might check a little bit later on your app to be able to download. It's like an 8-page document that is a summary of the history of this place. And that's an important part for us to get into our mind if we're going to, again, converse with people in the world about whether or not a Christian can support Israel. What does that look like? Understanding what's happened in the past is huge. So the other thing I want to mention to you before we give this history is that history is complicated and it is extensive. And historians can be somewhat biased, and they don't get it all in sometimes. Just like you're going to see in my handout. I didn't get it all in. Here's just one example of how complicated this is. With the city of Jerusalem itself, Jerusalem alone has been attacked 52 times since its existence. It's been captured and recaptured 44 times, besieged 23 times, destroyed twice, and controlled by 15 different governmental entities. So as you'll see on the outline that I'm providing of a chronology of history, the Jebusites, the Canaanites, the Jebusites that lived there were probably some of the first to control that area, control the city of Jerusalem, that is. And then as time goes by, we know that David and his men captured the city from the Jebusites, so the biblical country of Israel that was both a religious nation and a civic nation. They had laws by which they lived by and a king that governed them. They controlled that particular area. Now, we'll talk more tomorrow. Well, are the Jews there now? Descendants of the Jews that were there then? We'll kind of maybe quickly address that issue. But nevertheless, I just want you to see that this is a long and complicated history just with the city of Jerusalem itself. So not only with this disclaimer am I saying that, you know, it's complicated, it's difficult to try to get all in, but I want you to also understand this. You can't talk about history without overgeneralizing. How can we possibly talk about every single event where maybe some Arabic family that was definitely mistreated in the West Bank by Israeli soldiers? Does that happen all the time? I don't believe it does. Does it happen sometimes? I think you could argue that it does. But also, we can't forget about the time that maybe an Arabic family came across, or an Arabic individual came across into Israel and blew himself up on the streets of Jerusalem where there were nothing but Jewish citizens. I can't go and tell you every story because it's just going to be this and this and this and this and this all day long. So we have to overgeneralize to some extent and realize that there's a great deal of bias, even in the making of the maps that you're going to see here in just a moment. Because the map that I'm going to use to show you kind of what happened to Israel is a map that wasn't used from my perspective. When I saw it, I went, oh, I see, yeah, this makes perfect sense. But they weren't using it to try to gain sympathy for the nation of Israel. They were using it to try to gain sympathy for people in the West Bank. All right, well, maybe that will make it a little more sense in just a moment, okay? All right, so the other thing that we need to keep in mind as Christians when we're looking at all this is that its history is deeply rooted in both religious fervor and political nationalism. We'll talk more about that in just a moment with regard to nationalism. But today, the city of Jerusalem, as well as all of Israel, is made up of highly ultra-Orthodox religious people who don't even believe that Israel has a right to exist as a nation. That's bizarre, isn't it? Yet they're living there, and they're glad to live under the military protection that it provides, and they even receive taxes from the government, but yet Israel doesn't have a right to exist nationalistically. So it's very diverse in terms of its views, but yet religion and politics are extremely all wrapped in this together. But why is this territory so, so important? The most important shrine in all of what I would consider rabbinical Judaism, and I would say probably mostly Judaism overall today, is the Western Wall. It's the vestige of the temple, the retaining wall that was created into the central valley to give Herod a larger platform to build the temple that he did when he came into power. So that Temple Mount area wasn't large enough. Let's build, expand the base of it. And the way that he did that was build a retaining wall to the west, one to the south, and a little bit on the east and south as well. Side gave him a bigger platform. And so when in AD 70, when the Romans destroyed all of this, they threw all the buildings down from the top. They destroyed it, burned it, and all that remains then are the retaining walls of that era. Okay. So, for many Jews, for some Jews, this is an important shrine because to them it's the closest place on earth that you can come and communicate and feel close to God and the vestige of his temple. On top then, what is there? Well, in roughly 658 AD, the Muslims built the Dome of the Rock, where it is said that Muhammad came on a night's journey from a literal huge outcropping of a rock here, where many people say, and I feel like this is it, where the actual Ark of the Covenant would have rested somewhere in that area in there, and that he left on a night's journey to visit Allah and then came back here, and so this mosque is built there, and then there's another huge one, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, down south of the Temple Mount area. So you've got Judaism, modern-day Judaism, we've got Islam, and then for a lot of the, quote, Christian world now, in a larger sense of that term, it's important because this is where Jesus came. We're interested in knowing about these places, and we want to see where it occurred, and we can use the information from an apologetic standpoint to defend the faith and so forth, okay? So there are a number of church buildings all scattered around all over the country, both from the Byzantine era as well as, you know, the modern era throughout time, but even today, that are still in use where people go to worship. So as we think about this modern period, what's going on? What's happening? We can divide it really into four periods, and I'm going to go through these quickly just because of time. From ancient times to the end of World War I, that's very important. So from biblical times, what happened then? Number two, the British Mandate, 1917-1948. Then number three, we want to talk about the establishment of the State of Israel. And then number four, our present Israeli-Arabic wars and the Gazan-Israeli conflict or war that's been going on. Okay, so this is several bullet points, but here we go. So this is important groundwork for understanding what's been happening. 1406, Israelites conquered. 586, the Jews are driven out by Assyrians and the Babylonians. Northern 10 tribes and the southern 2 tribes. What happens to them? Here we go, right here. The religious and ethnic Judaism, or religious and ethnic Judaism, begins to spread around Europe, around the world. It spreads across Asia and Europe. We call it the diaspora, the dispersion. Some of those Jews are going to come back, and they're going to resettle parts of the land. But they don't have control of it as a separate political entity, ruling itself. That's it. When they're carried away from by the Babylonians, that's it, until, as we'll see in just a moment, the Hasmonean period. But you have a succession of empires that control the land between. What today we're referring to as Israel and the West Bank and Gaza. Assyria, Persia, and then you do have a brief period here of when the Jews revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes, who was a Ptolemaic ruler, the vestige of the Greek Empire, Alexander the Great's empire that was divided into four, they go back and forth controlling this land between Ptolemaic and the Seleucid empires. And ultimately then, in 167, there is a revolt. They gain their independence, but it's short-lived. So this is the last time, until modern times, that the people who claim a Jewish heritage, we can argue about their bloodline and all of that all day long and so forth, but they are claiming they are of a Jewish heritage. I mean, something happened to those people as they intermarried, and there's vestiges of them somewhere, I guess, right? So who are they? Well, people that are identifying themselves as of Jewish ethnicity and Jewish blood have come back and established the state of Israel. Well, as time goes by, then we have the Roman Byzantine period, which was the so-called Christianizing of the Roman Empire. A lot of church buildings are built by Helena, who was the mother of Constantine. And then you've got these periods, notice, when they're under control of Iraq and Cairo and the Crusader period. And then finally, the Palestine is incorporated into the Ottoman Empire. This is where it's important again. So as all this time goes by, from the time that the nation of Israel first came in here, a lot of this property has changed hands many times. But the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Ottoman Empire, as they took control of Constantinople and it became known as Istanbul, then this huge empire began to expand. In fact, Suleiman the Great, who came to power in the early 16th century, was the one that built a lot of the walls that you see in the old city of Jerusalem today. When you go there, you see these massive walls, and you go, wow, this is beautiful, and it's great, and it's so old. Now, it's not really that old. Although it's old to us in America, it's not that old. There are portions of the wall that do date back to the time of Christ, and a few of them here and there that do date back to the first temple period. Nevertheless, the Ottoman Empire takes control over the land between. Now, so here it is. So there is the Ottoman Empire. Look at what all they control now. Up until 1917, what happens in 1917?
World War I.
Before we get there, important question. Who was living in Palestine before the present conflict? As Jews began to slowly migrate back, in fact, some of them had never even really left the northern territories. A huge enclave in Galilee. All of a sudden, I can't think of the name of the town. Probably help me there. Right outside of Galilee. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But a huge, huge, important rabbinic location study center developed there, not too far from the Sea of Galilee. And so many of them moved, but notice population had risen to about 10,000, and the town had become a thriving textile center in that area. The country's Jewish population slowly improved. The first neighborhood outside of the walls of Jerusalem in 1860. Who's living there now? Jews, Arabic people that are Muslim people that are from the Ottoman Empire. And by 1880, Jerusalem had a large Jewish population that was land for farming, was purchased throughout the country, and new rural settlements were set up. So what is that all driving to? Here we go. Look at this. Christians, Muslims, and Jews were all living together in Jerusalem, just as an example of the land between, in the 1800s, when the Ottoman Empire controlled this area. The Ottoman Empire, yes, had a lot of interest in Jerusalem and Israel, but not as much there in the south as they did in the other parts of their empire, in the Asia Minor area. I mentioned this guy here. I put his picture up here because this is Dr. Barclay. Some of you will remember that he was the first preacher of the missionary society sent out by Alexander Campbell and others to come and do mission work in Jerusalem. And so in the 1860s, 50s and 60s, he came there and he established the Lord's Church, a body of Christians there in Jerusalem. So today there's actually a gate that is named for him that he discovered that's called Barclay's Gate that he discovered from the inside of the Temple Mount. That was one of the first major entrances into the Temple Mount complex from the Herodian period. All right, so I mentioned all that. Look, Ottoman brothers, Muslim, Christians, Jews in early 20th century power, they're all dwelling here. Were there problems? Yeah, skirmishes, but there's hospitality, kindness, people were there. All right. I'm not arguing, okay, which family got there first and who had that parcel of land here and who had that parcel of land. I'm just saying that they were all there at this point in the discussion, okay? Another element that's important now, what's beginning to develop at the end of the 1800s, is what's called Zionism. And Zionism is basically a nationalistic movement that says, we the people, as remember the diaspora, the dispersion, they're all over the Mediterranean world. And Jews don't have a place to go when they're being persecuted. Where is our homeland? We're living in Germany. We thought this was a great place to live as a Jew. And all of a sudden our own government turns to us. Where do we go where there is a national government that is going to take care of religious Jews? They didn't have a place anywhere in the world. And so a guy by the name of Theodor Herzl, big cemetery devoted and dedicated to him outside of modern-day Jerusalem today. There is a cemetery. He really started this movement. We need to get back to Israel. We need more people moving back there. We need to create a state there. All right, that's late 1800s. Who owns the land between right now? The Ottoman Empire still does. Okay. World War I is... right, you know, in the middle of things, Ottoman Empire begins to shrink, and now the Allied countries of World War I, who are opposing Germany, they begin to take control of this what was once Ottoman territory. Notice the Russians, the British, the French, they get control of this area. Land is lost and won by various wars, and then by the end of World War I, because we're not really sure how to best handle this, because the British are going to help establish an Iraqi government, and the French are going to help establish a Syrian government. Have y'all ever seen, I think it was Peter O'Toole that played in the movie...
Lawrence of Arabia.
Yes, Lawrence of Arabia. And he's trying to unite these Arabic people into becoming a nation, but they can't quite do it, okay? So all of this land that had once belonged to the Ottoman Empire is beginning to be divided up. Well, what do we do about the land between? So the League of Nations at that time said, we'll turn it over to the British and let them handle it. Y'all figure this out. You control this area. So the British Mandate, during this time, issued the Balfour Declaration, which says, basically it was a pledge to the Jewish people. It says, in this area, help us, because they were concerned about what was going on in the United States with regard to Jewish support of World War I. And listen, we'll declare that you guys will have a homeland if you'll get behind us and support this war. So they made a promise. And today, National Israel really speaks a lot about the Balfour Declaration. There are successive waves during this time of immigration that are occurring, but finally the British say no more. You aren't coming here anymore. And a lot of conflict began to happen between the British, the Arab, and the Israeli people. Everybody's got blood on their hands in this story, I can tell you. Because there were 57 violent attacks carried out by Zionist terrorist groups. These are Jewish groups. I'm not saying that they were necessarily the Haredim or anything like that, the religious ultra Orthodox, but they were Jewish nationalists. And they began to oppose the British government. And there were a number of terrorist activities that occurred. So, in 1947, when finally, because this rocks along until World War II comes to an end, and what's the population look like? Look how it's all scattered around. The blue is privately owned Jewish land. The green is privately owned Arab land. And the white is public and state owned land. It's all scattered in here. We begin to see a little bit of the complicated element to all of this. Okay. So in 1947, the United Nations begins to get involved now, the newly formed United Nations, and say, all right, what are we going to do with this? We have all these other Arab countries, and some of my Jewish friends today will make that point. Look at all the Middle East. How many Arabic countries, Muslim-dominated countries, are there in the Middle East and the Near East? How many Jewish states or even democracies are there? And they'll say, we're the only one. They got all this land, but we got nothing? That's part of the argument. So, the United Nations came up with what they call the partition plan. Look at this. They said, all right, Jews, you can have this. We'll give this to the Jewish people, and they can form their own nation, And you of the Arabic world can form your own nation, and this is your land. We'll divide it. The trouble is that you've got Arabic people that are living here. I've been to a community called Abu Ghosh of Arabic people who were in that area, and they were given a chance by the Israelis during the 1947-48 war to say, do you want to fight with us or them? They said, we want to fight with you. And today, it's a thriving community. We stop there and eat every time we come back on our way to the airport. And this Arabic community that is loyal to Israel. Muslim, minarets standing in the city of Abu Ghosh today. All right, so it's not all neat and nice. So how are we going to do this? Well, at least it's a plan. And the Jews said, you know what? We get the desert. Okay, we don't get Jerusalem. That's going to be a United Nations controlled area. But you know what? We'll take it. They said, we accept. The Arab world said no. So the Jordanians, the Egyptians, and the Syrians all had a war, and they fought this war thinking that they're just going to wipe Israel off the map. And you know, it's really incredible, some heroism and the things that took place in the War of Independence, because the United States didn't want to really get involved in that battle at all. Many other countries did. We'd just gone through a bloody, you know, five-year war in World War II in Europe, and now we're going to sit. So they just kind of tried to, you know, cleanse their hands of it to some degree. But to everyone's amazement, the Jewish people won their independence. And they got control of this land. Now I want you to notice something here. What is called the West Bank Territory today, after that war was over, right after World War II, this War of Independence, the Jordanians said, this is our territory. And the Egyptians said, we get all the Sinai Peninsula and we get the Gaza Strip. That's how it looked up until 1967. So it's a little bit of a misnomer to say, well, there was a Palestinian state here. There wasn't. Now, were there Arabic people here? Yes, but the argument is they fled during the war. They're not truly people that were there. It's just a quagmire of debate and discussion about it all. I'm not saying that I agree with everything that happened and how it happened, but having some memory of the past is going to help us to understand what's going on in the present. So Jordan took control of this. I've even seen the remains of the Hashemite Kingdom's king who was building a palace over here that was still part of it standing today, that was basically left by 1967, went down. It's 1967 war takes place, the Six Days War, when all the Arab countries and around the area said, we're going to move in on these territories. We're going to wipe out Israel. And a part of it had to do, again, with what was going on down here at the Straits of Turan down here. And the Egyptians had blocked it off. And so Israel, in a preemptive attack, pushed all the way over here to Egypt. They gained control of the Sinai Peninsula. They took control of the West Bank. They took control of the Gaza Strip. They took control of the Golan Heights. And then all of that territory. And after 6 days, the dust settled and they began to try to have a treaty. Now, depending on who you talk to, some say, Israelis, all right, we're going to give you this back. We'll give you the Gaza Strip. And the Egyptians said, we don't want it. You handle it. All right, Jordan, these are your people. They've been, you know, under your, you gave them citizenship rights in the last few years. We don't want it. So Jordan came over here. This left then this problem of the so-called occupied territory of the West Bank. Who controls it? Who has a right to live there? And that's then, as time goes by, Palestinian Liberation Organization develops to sort of reclaim its rights in the area. Years later, the Oslo Accords happen. Huge concessions are made by the Israeli government as well as the Palestinian people. In 1992, remember, some of you are alive, you remember that day. Yasser Arafat and all the celebration and everything that took place, and finally peace is coming to the Middle East and it's all going to be okay. And folks, there have been extremists in every group, in every period of time to keep it from happening. And I can tell you, one of the sad things about all this, right after this was happened, then it just got worse. So Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated by a Jewish extremist. He gave up too much territory. What was he doing? All right. Palestinian Authority is created to control both Gaza and the West Bank. But now here we go. I have to get ahead here quickly. This is the last thing. A terrorist organization infiltrates here. Also, a court said we'll have one basic authority. You will be ruled by the same Palestinian Authority. They elected a president. First one was Yasser Arafat. Later on, then Hamas becomes the next one. And there's supposed to be an election every year. I mean, every 3 or 4 years. Hasn't been one. He's remained as the president of this area. In the meantime, they were infiltrated by a terrorist group. Now, this is important. What we're going to talk about tomorrow. What do they believe? What are they trying to achieve? And you know what? I've read every word of their manifesto. And their manifesto says that this is consecrated territory. I'm sorry, Jerusalem and all of this area is consecrated territory. When Saladin, in the Crusader period, conquered that area, he made it once and forever Arabic land. And the Jews have no right to be there. And we will never rest until the Jews are completely wiped off the face of the earth. Okay. So there's going to continue to be some of this, but I want you to know what has happened is quite frightening, because if you think about the series of events between Gaza then, after they were taken over by Hamas, and Israel, has been one bloody affair after another, and finally it ended in what we know, the October 7th massacre, thousands of Jewish innocent people were brutalized. It was a horrific act of violence that was perpetrated upon the Israeli people. Again, you can disagree about it all, but we'll tomorrow pick that subject up then. How do we approach all of this, and what should we do?